Right then. So you've spent a few minutes looking at those examples of fictional narratives, and I'm very impressed already. So somebody said, what are the answers? You're business-like people. You know. Get down to the... Well, at least some of you are. Maybe all of you are. I want to issue a couple of caveats first. Like I said before, I'm no expert on world literature. I know a little about the Bible, and I used to know something about physics, but I'm not the person you'd invite to speak to you about Shakespeare. I've learned a lot from reading Booker's book, and so I can give you what he thinks, although he himself would say that many of these stories are themselves mixtures of one or more, two or more of these plots. Now, what's happening here, as we're thinking about what these ladies who are thinking about the strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, it encourages you to look at the story in a fresh way, doesn't it? So do you want to tell us just briefly, you put Jekyll and Hyde into two boxes, didn't you?
Yes.
Go on. Three. Good grief, I turned my back for 2 minutes. And oh my goodness. Such creativity. Is there a main category you'd want to put it in?
It starts obviously with overcoming the monster.
Right.
Is that the monster within, or are you looking at a physicality?
Right.
Exactly. Dr. Jekyll is going on a quest because he's trying very hard to work out the inner psyche that he's looking at. And we thought also tragedy because of what happens in the end.
Right.
But also there's a bit of a rebirth because although he's come back as that awful character,
in rebirth. Yes, it's a that negative rebirth. It's a tragic rebirth. What did other people? Did you have?
I'm a bit sketchy as to what happens at the end. I mean, I don't want spoilers.
And of course, if you think, oh, I've never watched Macbeth, never read Jekyll and Hyde. Well, you know, it's not a test, don't worry. But does anybody else have any? Was there one category that people put Jekyll and Hyde into? Jeremy, you were nodding. It's a tragedy. It's definitely a tragedy. Self-destructive, and yet, of course, it's the. Like so many tragedies, it is not the destruction that comes from outside, but from within. Yeah. And once you say that, you then say, okay, it's a bit like a quest, isn't it? It's not a geographic quest or a quest through time. It's a quest, it's searching within himself to find something. Okay, now what's happening here is you're starting to think in different and creative ways about a story that perhaps you know quite well, perhaps you dimly remember from years past. This is what we're going to be doing with the Bible's narratives very shortly. We're practicing on fiction. It doesn't matter so much fiction. So, well done. Booker says this is a tragedy. And he would know. I mean, he wrote the book. So. All right. Well done, Jeremy. 1-0. Okay, right. Shout out dominant answers. Okay, Sleeping Beauty. And there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. Sleeping Beauty, what is it? Rebirth, yeah. Most obviously a rebirth, isn't it? From the point of view of Prince Charming, or whatever his name is, it's a quest. Very good. So what's happening, you're starting to think of the narrative from the point of view of different characters. Any other boxes you tick?
Overcoming the monster.
Yeah, it is. Charles Dickens, Christmas Carol. This one fascinated me, actually.
Comedy.
Comedy, yeah. Rebirth. We've got a couple of rebirths. Yeah, it's overcoming the monster. It's the monster within. Booker classifies this as a rebirth. And this is, I found fascinating, because he's drawing attention to the fact that Scrooge is imprisoned in this dungeon of greed. And he needs to be born out of it. And of course the three ghosts and then the little lad on the crutches, what's his name? It's hard to say. And these, the people against whom his greed and selfishness was previously directed become the very source of his rebirth. Yeah? So it's a wonderful twist on that story. Macbeth. We all know what Macbeth is, don't we? Because anybody who's studied it. It's a tragedy. And again, you then think, okay, so it's a tragedy. That's a fairly well-established category, and people have thought about that a fair amount. Let's just keep going. Jekyll and Hyde.
I'm used to thinking sort of tragedy, comedy, or history. Are all stories... I mean, you said all stories either end badly or well.
Right.
So is there a sense in which they're all either... comedy or tragedy or...
Yeah, in one sense. And this goes back to a question that Mark and I were talking about. How do you decide to break down these? If you have all world literature, do you put them in one category labelled story? Do you put them in 5, 6, 7 categories? And if so, are they these categories? Or do you then divide these categories into further categories? Do you have... a tragedy in which the hero dies or a tragedy in which the villain dies? Because different tragedies encourage the reader to sympathise or not to sympathise with the main figure. So, for example, Samson, the life of Samson is tragic. And by the end you feel bad because you think, here's a man who had so much. And yet, really, his life ended in... I mean, he killed more Philistines in his death than in his life, etc., etc. He brought the temple down on himself. A picture of Christ, in a way, but a tragic picture of Christ. Wished that it could have been better. Whereas the tragedy of the devil... Well, he is a character you're not supposed to sympathise with. Just for the sake of clarity, we're not supposed to sympathise with him. We're supposed to sympathise and feel for Samson, but not for the devil. So where's Judas? And how much do you feel for him? Do you sympathise? Or did he get what was coming? You know, it makes you... Now, I just asked that question, and it forces you to meditate on what the Bible is saying to us in the life of Judas. It's actually quite sobering, because he's a real person. Yeah. Tragedy. Okay. Pilgrim's Progress. Here's an easy one. Come on. Quest. I think we pretty much all agree it's a quest. And actually it's quite a simple story. It's allegorical character makes it, you know, everything is explained on the way through. Good old Bunyan. King Solomon's Mines. I only read this recently. Another quest. Cinderella we talked about, didn't we? Who shouted out earlier? Said that they, that's right. Penny, what's Cinderella? How do you put...
Well, it is right, Bridges.
Right, very good.
It's a tragedy for the ugly sisters.
Right, yes. It is, isn't it? So you've got two distinctly interwoven stories. Now, just notice, so a quest and a tragedy. Well, Jeremy, you read earlier, Prodigal Son. It's Voyage and Return.
What, which
one is
Cinderella?
Oh, it's Prodigal Son. It's Voyage and Return for one character, the younger brother. But for the older brother, what is it? Tragedy? How do you know?
We don't know how it finishes up.
Exactly. We don't know how it finishes up. Maybe it's tragic. Maybe he stayed out in the fields. I refuse to go and celebrate your mercy to this son of yours, Dad. Not brother of mine, this son of yours. Maybe it ends in tragedy. Or maybe... we are invited to consider. Maybe his heart was softened as he stood out in the freezing rain, listening to the music and smelling the fattened calf cooking. So what happens there is a brilliant piece of teaching through a story where the end is left open. You don't know what happens. And who did Jesus tell that story to? To some who were confident of their own righteousness and to people who thought they were above things in religious terms, the Pharisees, and he told them the lost sheep, lost coin, lost son, and the older brother bit of the lost son is directed at them, and it's inviting them to say, look, are you going to be like the older brother, or are you going to welcome these unclean Gentiles into the kingdom of God?
And that could reflect a lot of us actually, because of really reluctant to accept new Christians into the fold, because we think that we're already Christians, and why could they come in?
Yeah. They might have all kinds of funny ideas. Goodness gracious. They might not like the organ. They might want to play the guitar, for goodness sake, and everybody knows that the whole book of Leviticus is against guitars or something. Let me tell you a story. I once began a sermon like this, and it was a joke. Okay? It was not a joke, it was fiction, but it's how it started. Some of you know that I am I'm connected with a ministry called Caring for Ex-Offenders. Caring for Ex-Offenders works by helping people who have convicts who have been converted inside to find a church and settle down when they come out. And you know, lots of people come out of prison every year in London, and occasionally I get a call saying that there's somebody come out, young man or young woman, who's been converted and wants to find a church. And I got a call like that last week. And I need to explain a little bit about this guy because, he's asked me to, and he's not here now, he's going to come along later. I need to tell you a little bit about him, just so you're prepared. Some people, when they go inside, they did something small, not this man. And I listed a fairly lurid series of crimes, which he said, I should share these with you. Now, he wants me to assure you that he's repentant of his sins, and yet he knows that some of you will be a little bit nervous about meeting him, and about your children meeting him, the ex-paedophile, Johnny. But we'll meet him at coffee time today. And you could have heard a pin drop in a church, tell you. And we have carpet, you know. Now, I think that was an introduction to the parable of the prodigal son. I think that was a sermon, I don't recall exactly, but I remember the introduction, it stuck in my mind. Some of the things I preach I remember, how is that? Because it's actually such an important aspect of our own faith. How well are we going to look out for the outsiders? Yeah? Or are we going to be so frightened that they'll disrupt our status quo that we become like the Pharisees? So there's an example of how that thinking about the Bible in that kind of way helps us to grapple with it. Let's skip through a few more. Jane Eyre, anyone a Bronte fan? Jane Eyre? Back to Richard.
Back to
Richard. It's a voice that says that a big long walk in the countryside, isn't she? It's a rebirth in lots of ways, but a bigger pun.
I think it's a bit tragedy as
well for the. Yeah, that's right. Easy one. Jack and the Beanstalk. Overcoming the monster, big giant at the top of the beanstalk. War of the Worlds. Overcoming the monster. Remember the story? The aliens take it over and it's a bacteria that kills them. Now here's intriguing. The line written in the wardrobe. See if it is. Right. Now that's fascinating. Why is the line written in the wardrobe one of the best known children's stories of the 20th century? It's a biblical allegory, and therefore, surprise, surprise, it is every element. Isn't it remarkable? So Edmund, rebirth, from his own wintry frustration. Voyage in Return, well, everybody is Voyage in Return. Rags to Riches, well, you see these little kids become kings and queens of Narnia. Overcoming the Monster, etc., etc. You see that? Now, just to think about Narnia in those terms, and we listen to it on CD in the car with kids, they love it, they'd happily go on. They'd happily drive around the M25, you know, 15 times, just so they could listen to all the Narnia stories. It's all those stories. Lord of the Rings. Quest. It's called a quest, isn't it? Overcoming the Monster. Yeah, exactly. And of course it has all these tangled subplots, doesn't it? It's longer, much longer than Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. So it's going to have many other stories woven within it. Okay, fantastic. There's no comedies in here, I guess other things. Shakespeare is a place to look for comedy. Shakespeare, Book of Highlights, really drew comedy together as a genre and explored it. Was it 16 comedies he wrote or something? Midsummer Night's Dream, Taming the Shrew, all these kinds of things that are comedies. Beautiful stories. Okay, let me pause for a second. Any questions? Okay. Now, I'm feeling like a bit warm, so I can easily take my jacket off, which is unheard of. But if other people are warm like me, then maybe turn the heating down a bit would be, but I'll leave that up to you. See what it feels like. Now, when do we finish this session, Marco?
12:45.
12:45, okay. Now, I promised you a biblical comedy. And so I'm going to invite you to come with me on the course of the whole Bible. Have you got a Bible handy?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, grab a Bible. And this is my answer, part of my answer to John's question. I'd like you, please, to turn with me to the book of Genesis, chapter 1, verse 26. And I'm going to take you on a tour through the Bible to show you how it is a comedy. Remember what a comedy is? Is a story in which you can't figure out for the life of you how all the elements are going to fit together until the end when suddenly you discover what it's all about. Genesis chapter 1, verse 26 to 28 highlights what people are for. Let me read it to you. God said, "Let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them do what?" What is Adam supposed to do? Somebody tell me, somebody shout out. Rule. Okay, so I'm going to draw a little crown on here. Adam, and here's Eve. Eve, we learn too, has dominion tasks in the Bible. Rule is not just something for the man, it is for the woman as well. So this is Adam and Eve. Now, in one sense, then, we won't read the whole of that section, it's a very famous section, 26-28. The whole purpose of human history is to have a king and queen, or multiple kings and queens, ruling over the creation, taking dominion, bringing it to fruitfulness, taking this uncultivated wilderness and turning it into a beautiful garden and building cities and making it wonderful. Okay, that's what humanity is for. Now, you know that pretty soon it goes badly wrong, okay, when these things get rubbed out because they are thrown out of the garden in Genesis chapter 3. Verses 1 to 7, they sin against God, and then they're thrown out of the garden pretty soon afterwards. So this then raises the question, what will happen to this kingship plan? When are we going to get a king, and where is the king going to come from? And so if you were reading the Bible with this story in mind, you might be asking yourself the question, I wonder who's going to be a king? Well, who's the next candidate? The obvious candidate is the next person to be born, whose name, you recall, is Cain. Very good. Well, it's not a terribly good idea to have as a king a guy who murders his brother, as is first recorded out in the Bible. And so that sets the stage for the unfolding of human history. And as the generations descend, what you notice is they just get worse and worse and worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. And you're left asking this question, where is a king going to come from? Now the answer begins to be highlighted in Genesis chapter 12, when we meet a chap called, and I rubbed Cain out because he's just such a bad, messy character, we need space. We meet a chap called Abraham. And from Abraham we discover Genesis. Oh, all right, let me get rid of that. Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 to 3. From Abraham the solution will come. Abraham, his name is changed to Abraham, but he's Abraham at the beginning. Click over to Genesis 12. The story of finding a king is going to be focused on Abraham and his descendants. The history of Genesis is, from chapter 12 onwards, a history of Abraham and his descendants. So you might have thought, when God says to Abraham, go from your country and your kindred to your father's house to the land I'll show you, and I'll make of you a great nation. Well, here's the obvious candidate for the king. So the great nation is going to come from him, then clearly he'll be the king. So if he can find a way to have, you know, a dozen or so children, and then they have a dozen or so children, he'll be forming a great nation, you know, a few hundred people fairly quickly within his lifetime. But there's a problem. Of course, Abraham can't have children very easily. And so Isaac eventually appears. Isaac, after a struggle. Then Jacob, after a struggle. And it is only Jacob who eventually is blessed with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, is blessed with the kind of fruitfulness that would give him the descendants, the great nation from which a king might conceivably come. So we've got the 12 sons of Jacob, whose names were... My kids know something about this. Benjamin at this end. Okay, it's very good. Okay, you know all this. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher, Issachar, Zebulun, Joseph, and Benjamin. Right, now turn with me to the end of Jacob's life, because he's going to tell us something very interesting. Genesis chapter 49. Jacob is gathering with his sons on his deathbed. Sit with me, Genesis 49. Here's how it goes. And remember, our question is, who is going to be king? And by king, I'm including the kingship, the rule that is extended also to men and both men and women in God's image. But in this context, it's 12 boys who are addressed by Jacob. And notice what happens, chapter 49, verse 1. Jacob called his sons and said, "Gather yourselves together, that I may tell you what shall happen in days to come." So maybe Genesis 49 will contain a hint of who is going to be the king. And we read down, "Reuben, you are my firstborn." Says nothing about a king. Verse 3. Skim down, 4, 5. Oh, Simeon, Levi, brothers. Says nothing about a king. Oh, hold on. Verse 8 mentions which man? Judah. We all know Judah because, oh yeah, something about the tribe of Judah. Right. "Your brothers shall praise you. Your hands shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's son shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's cub. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He stoops down. He crouches a lion. As a lioness, you dare to rout him. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until tribute comes to him. And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples." He is the one. Judah. Hallelujah. Judah. He is the guy who is going to be the king. Well, problem solved then. He is the one who will receive, quote, "the obedience of the peoples," which was promised to Abraham. So here's Judah, and we're all thinking, well, no problem now, we've got our king. Why is Judah not going to be crowned king straight away? Well, there's a problem. Let's look at what kind of a man Judah was. And think about his offspring. Turn back with me a few chapters to Genesis 38. There is a problem with Judah. Genesis 38. Judah had three sons, at least by the time Genesis 38 was written, and their names were... I'll draw this out here. Anybody know the names of Judah's three sons? Don't worry if you don't. It's kind of an obscure part of the Old Testament. Onan and Shelah, which is not apparently a lady's name, like in the Bible. Shelah is a man's name, Shelah, actually, the accent's at the end. So, Onan and Shelah. Now, you might expect, okay, Judah should be king and these people should be the beginning of the nation whom he rules over. But before we leap to conclusions, let's just check out how the marriages went and what kind of a family this was. Genesis 38, Judah went down to his brothers and so on and so forth. He married somebody and he had three children. Verse 4, Onan, verse 5, Shelah. Now, Judah took a wife for and her name was, anybody? Tamar. Oh, sorry, she should be a lady, not a man. There we are. Tamar. So, naturally, if Judah is the man from whom kingship is going to come, you might have expected him, or maybe is the natural candidate for the kingship. But there's a problem. Verse 7. Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord put him to death. And since he's dead, he can't be king, because there's only one man in the Bible who can be king after he's died. Is dead. So what happened? Well, it's very simple. The law of Leviticus 25. No, 23. No, Deuteronomy 25, that's right. The Levirate marriage law is Leviticus 23, I think. Don't worry about that. Deuteronomy 25, the Levite marriage regulation, Deuteronomy 25, provided for the brother of the dead man to marry his wife, assuming he wasn't married already, so as to provide children and an inheritance for her. But Onan didn't... I won't drag you through the messy narrative. Onan didn't like the thought of being his father to his brother's heir. Take a look if you insist. In verse 9, "And the Lord doesn't like people who break his law so selfishly, and so the Lord put him to death also." So it's not looking great for the dynasty of Judah. So don't worry, it's okay, Tamar, you can marry Shelah, except there's a problem marrying Shelah. Verse 11, Shelah's still about this tall. Shelah is a little boy. So it's okay, what's going to happen is, Judah says, verse 11, "Wait, remain in your father's house, and you will be provided for. You will be provided for when Sheila grows up. So we're waiting for the day when a king can come from this line. Okay. Now, in the course of why, time, verse 12, Judah's wife died, years of passing on, and in the verse 14, this poor woman, who is now probably quite elderly, realises that though Sheila has grown up, she is not going to be given his hand in marriage. Fairly easy to understand why. He's probably 20. She's probably 45. Probably prefers a younger model. Like so many men down the ages. So he refused to fulfil his obligation to God and to his brother, and left her destitute. So she went and she sat by the side of a road, and who should come along but Judah. And one thing led to another, as things so often do when a man is away on business in a strange land, and the two of them spent the evening together. This is Judah. And Tamar became pregnant. Here come the children. Now, of course, Judah finds out that his daughter-in-law is pregnant by immorality, and he's furious because she's done something disgraceful. Again, this is often how men treat women through the ages. The woman gets the blame, and a man gets off scot-free. So this, he knows who the husband is because the father has left the token with her. So everybody knows that Judah is the father, and these children are born illegitimately. Their names are Perez and Zerah. Zerah means seed, and Perez means outbreak or something, broken out. Here they are. Now, just look at the family tree. You might have thought, given the family tree, that Judah's supposed to be king, well, he's not doing a great job. Maybe the first guy who legitimately might be able to claim any right to be king would be Perez. And indeed, that would be right, except for one small detail. Just look with me at Deuteronomy chapter 23. Flick forward, you'll find it. Deuteronomy chapter 23. And look with me at verse 2. Deuteronomy 23, verse 2. If you found it, it explains a very great deal. No one, verse 2, no one born of a forbidden union may enter the assembly of the Lord. Even to the 10th generation, none of his descendants may enter the assembly of the Lord. Now just think what that means. This man, Perez, is not allowed to be a full part of the community of the people of God. He's not allowed to worship with the people of God. He's not allowed to, so to speak, enter the people. It wouldn't really make much sense for him to be king. And neither can his son, or his son's son, down for 10 generations. We need 10 generations from Perez before a king may legitimately come from the line of Judah and rule over the people of God. So we need 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Now this is an interesting period of history. This whole period of history is recounted in the book of, I'm sorry, you have to read sideways, Judges. In the book of Judges, we discover a downhill 10-generation-long slide into increasing chaos and immorality. And when you ask yourself the question, why did this happen? What was wrong with the land of Israel during the days of the Judges? This was just after the conquest. Joshua is now dead. The next generation, about 1400 BC to about 1000 BC, 400-year period, 10 generations. What's wrong with the people of Israel during this period? The answer is given in the very last verse of the book of Judges. So turn forth from Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, and turn to Judges chapter 21, verse 25, and tell me what's wrong with the people of Israel during these days. end of the book of Judges. Yeah? There's no king in Israel. Judges 21:25. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. There was 400 years of chaos in Israel because there's no king. There was 400 years of chaos in Israel because Judah slept with his daughter-in-law. And for 10 generations, no king was allowed in Israel because it had to come from this line, and yet none of them could enter the assembly. So we had 400 years of mess and chaos. And then you turn over, you keep on that page, and you look across to Ruth chapter 1, verse 1. In the days when the judges ruled, which is when the book of Ruth is set, there was a famine in the land, and a man from Bethlehem and Judah went and did all this stuff. And the four chapters of the book of Ruth are like a little light shining in the darkness. Because what the book of Ruth does is it tells us where, at last, this king is going to come from. And you know where you find that? You turn right to the end of the book of Ruth. And you find, after Ruth, the Moabite woman, comes back from Moab, she settles down, she looks after her mother-in-law, Naomi. She settles down with Boaz, her new husband, and they have a child. And the book ends with the genealogy of Ruth's offspring. Now just count the generations with me. These are the generations of Perez. Oh my goodness, it looks like Ruth has married into the line of Perez. Perez fathered Hezron, 2. Hezron fathered Ram. Ram fathered Amminadab. Amminadab fathered Nahshon. Nahshon fathered Salmon. Salmon fathered Boaz. Boaz fathered Obed. Obed fathered Jesse. And Jesse fathered who? 10 generations. The 10th man in line from the illegitimate offspring of Perez, the first man able to enter the assembly of the Lord, and also able legitimately to rule as king, was none other than David. Now just look what happened here. We have looked at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different books of scripture with at least 4 different human authors. Written over a period of several centuries by people who've never met, written in different settings, and edited together over probably about 1500 years to finally form the Bible we now have. And we've looked just briefly at a few little isolated passages from these texts. This, it seems to me, is the kind of comedy you couldn't make up. Right? If you watch a film version of this, you think that can only be fiction. That could never be. You seriously wanted to tell me that this happened and it was written by multiple people who'd never met each other? They only were writing one part of the story. In order for this to fit together as a single whole, there must have been, surely, there must have been one mind somehow superintending the process of all these people writing it. You can't write an intricate comedy if you've got 4 authors working independently. You can't do it. What you could do is have 4 or 5 authors all being guided and superintended by the sovereignty of God, all recording stuff that that same sovereign God had orchestrated over the better part of a millennium to get to the place where he wanted them to be. And then when you read on from the book of Ruth into the book of Samuel, we discover that this David is the shepherd boy stuck out in the hills of this rich town, Bethlehem, Ruth chapter 1 verse 1, who is raised up to be Israel's first legitimate king. Comedy. And you couldn't make it up.